welcome to a rebroadcast episode of Such Stuff. I'm David Bellwood, access manager at The Globe and occasional teller of unsettling tales. It's that magical time of year once again. The air is scented with the tinge of singed pumpkins, the edges of our towns and villages are all a little darker, and we're all in a mood to give each other a decent scare. This Halloween, we're revisiting 2018's Such Stuff episode, in which our intrepid podcaster, Imogen Greenberg, talks to Rob Hasty about some of the inexplicable happenings around Macbeth. She then opens the door to the prop store, where she discovers Susan Battersby and a collection of loose limbs. Then, lastly, Imogen speaks to her colleagues from around the globe about our unquiet workplace. The hustle and bustle of our audiences might not know it, but when they have all gone home after a play, our theatres are never exactly empty. So, this spooky season, trick and treat yourself to some uneasy listening, and I'll see you on the other side.
First up, we caught up with Macbeth director Rob Hasty. They're doing something a little different with the witches in this production, so we snuck into rehearsals to find out what they've been up to. We chatted superstitions, strange happenings, and why we don't say the title of the Scottish play.
Macbeth, 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 beware Macduff, beware the Thane of Fife.
What we've got really interested in is the mechanics of a spell, being that a group of people turn up at a particular time and place and say a collection of words in a particular order. And if you say the words in that order with the right intention, then something happens. And that seems to me to be, that's actually quite a good description of what a play is, that a group of people turn up, you know, at a specified time and place and say some words in the right order. And hopefully, if we've done our job, something happens. So we got talking about what scares us and what lines we wouldn't cross, and I'm a fully paid up rational secularist, pretty much 99% card stamped for atheism, and yet there are still things I wouldn't, you know, I don't really mess with tarot, I wouldn't do a Ouija board, I'm a bit scared of walking in a graveyard after dark, and not just because of earthly fears, but I'm a bit superstitious, it turns out. I thought I wasn't, but there were things that actually, when challenged, I go, actually, I probably wouldn't mess with that. And so we're all talking about the thing that you sort of don't want to do in case it invites something in. And the play is very much about, you know, two people who kind of look over into the abyss and step forward anyway. They sort of know that it's going to bring them nothing but misery, but they do it anyway. So we started thinking about what if, you know, voicing these witches, playing these witches, was something that you didn't really want to do. You didn't really want to be the person embodying the spirits that night, being the kind of instruments of darkness, which is what Banquo calls them. And so we thought, well, what if there is some sort of ritual or game whereby who has to embody the instruments of darkness is randomly selected? And could we do that for each performance? Could we do that on each occasion when we all turn up in this specified time and place and say this particular form of words and in the hope that something happens? So that's the idea, that's what we've been working with. And then, of course, we start having fun at looking at the ways, what kind of form that lottery or that ritual might take. I'm really interested in working on what the building gives us for free, what that space is asking of us. And in particular, looking at the candles that are such an integral part of that, the experience of coming to see something at the Wanamaker.
Where hast thou been, sister?
Killing swine.
Sister, where thou?
A sailor's wife had chestnuts in her lap, and munched, and munched, and munched. Give me, quoth I, or right thee, witch, the rump-fed runyon cries.
Yeah, some people were more up for it than others. Everyone was up for it, but some people did the maths and realised that meant learning a lot more dialogue than they'd signed up for. But everyone's got quite excited about the idea. When we've been trying it in the rehearsal room, there've been a couple of times we've looked at it in the rehearsal room when whichever method we've chosen to select the witches has thrown up the same person time and time again. Mark Elliott seems to be actually a witch. it sort of got to the point where even the most sceptical of us were going, hang on, there's something happening here. Or at least we did think that until we realised that he'd just been swapping his lottery ticket for with one of the other members of the cast who didn't know the lines yet to help him out.
But in a sieve I'll thither sail, and like a rat without a tail, I'll do, and I'll do.
I'll give thee a wind.
Thou art kind.
And I another.
And I myself have all the other. Though his bark cannot be lost, yet it shall be tempest tossed. Look what I have.
Show me, show me.
Here I have a pilot's thumb, racked as homeward he did come.
A drum, Macbeth doth come.
We had a conversation on the first day about this superstition that persists about saying the name of this play, saying the name of this play in not in context. There are sort of different variations on it, and different authorities will claim where it comes from. I have no problem in saying Macbeth, but the temptation to knock on something as soon as I've said it has grown over the course of the last few weeks. There were some actors in the company who didn't think that they would be anxious about saying that. But again, it's that feeling that I don't believe it, but better safe than sorry. You know, the mindset takes over whereby you go, well, it doesn't cost me to just be safe and do the little ritual that will protect me from the whatever. It does seep into your everyday behaviour, which is the slippery slope to superstition and eventually to the sort of mass delusions that lead to a kind of witch hunt. So today I'm going to step on cracks. And maybe one of the reasons why a superstition like the saying of the name of this play takes hold is because actors have to invest very deeply, emotionally, spiritually, physically, in something and in each other in a very short space of time. So actually picking up each other's tics, each other's nuances, each other's beliefs even, is inevitable when you're in a context where you're asking people to be that open and make themselves that vulnerable. So you can absolutely see where it comes from. And some of that stuff is useful as well. It's useful to kind of charge the atmosphere. Michelle's talked about how it's a deceptive space because it feels like it has a lot of history, but it doesn't. It's only 5 years old. It's a new theatre. It doesn't have its own ghosts yet. So we're working hard to try and put some ghosts into the seams. We're discovering every time we get into the theatre and do some rehearsal in there that it has its own very specific demands that it makes of performers. In lots of ways, it's the perfect space for this play, and the building itself is becoming a character in the story. One of the big questions of the play is, who killed Duncan? Now, in an immediate sense, it's Macbeth, but who's guiding Macbeth's hand? Is it his own volition? Has he been persuaded to do it by his wife? Has he been guided to it by the witches? Is it fate? Is it free will? And while those questions are in the air, there's something about that theatre that feels like it's a presence, that feels like it sort of wants to put itself on the suspects list.
The weird sisters, hand in hand, posters of the sea and land, thus do go about, thrice to thine and thrice to mine, and thrice again to make up nine.
Peace. The charm's wound up.
Access manager David Bellwood is generally known to be a huge fan of all things spooky. So this Halloween, I set him a very special mission. It's time to go ghost hunting around the globe. Here's David with a story of his own.
So, I have a reputation. I have a reputation for liking spooky things, and I love spooky things, especially horror movies. Even my mug at work is an homage to The Halloween Tree by Raymond Bradbury. I'm really into spooky things. I love them. It doesn't mean I'm not a cynic. I don't go around presuming that everything that I can't explain is supernatural. And generally around the globe, it's a very modern building. It feels very modern. That's fine. And I have been here for 10 years and never really witnessed anything. So this isn't a ghost story. It's not a supernatural story as such. It's probably just down to my overactive imagination. When I first started working at the Globe, my job was to lock up. It was I had to go around the building, and every door had its own key. and I had to lock every door in the whole site and switch off the lights in the room before I left it. So I was often in dark rooms or dark corridors locking a door. And sometimes, you know, new to the job, locking myself in. And the first week went fine because I had to be supervised. But the second week I was left to my own devices. In the attic, which is the heaven space above the globe, I had to go up and I had to switch off all the lights and I had to lock all the doors. So I went up by myself and there was a particularly difficult to get to part of the attic which I crawled into to switch off the lights. And for the first time, and it was only week two, but for the first time I noticed there was an array of offerings to Bacchus and Dionysus. And in true horror movie fashion, I chose that opportunity to speak to myself. And I said, yeah, right. I bet Dionysus comes here often for a quick quaff. Laughed at it, properly laughed at it. Felt a distinct drop in temperature and thought, I'm just going to leave this well enough alone. Switched off the lights, locked the door. Thought nothing more of it. And that night, I had a nightmare. And I'm not really prone to nightmares. And I think that's because of my addiction to horror movies. I'm just too full of scary stuff anyway. But I had a proper nightmare and it was about locking up the theatre. So I was in my nightmare in the attic once again and I had my back to the crawl spaces as I was locking this door and I could just feel the presence of this giant, angry shadow behind me. And it was terrifying. I was properly terrifying. It was proper panic in my dream. And there was this voice. And it wasn't really obviously this is a dream still. It wasn't really a physical voice. It was more sort of a voice inside my head, if you will. And it said, no laughing. And I freaking knew it was Dionysus. Woke up, cold sweats. Went back to sleep, fine. Woke up, thought, haha, you scared yourself silly at work. It was locking up dark rooms, so you can understand that. Next night comes 10:30 at night. I have to lock up. I'm back in the attic. And I sort of nod in acknowledgement to the offerings to Dionysus. I am far more respectful of this now. Thank you, subconscious. And as I close the doors towards the lift, the backstage lift, someone has put up a sign which reads, no laughing. And it freaked me out. No, I hadn't told anyone about the dream. It was clearly just someone backstage trying to get the cast to make sure they behaved themselves, side stage. And probably it was there the night before, but I just had no recollection of it. Probably it seeped into my subconscious, but I swear it hadn't. So that it's not a ghost story. That is not a ghost story, but that is the spookiest thing which has happened to me here by a long shot.
David searched high and low and turned up some pretty good stories. In the early days of our Globe Theatre, a security guard on night shifts used to see a woman in white walking across the yard. In the very first dress rehearsal of the very first show at the Globe, a photo was taken facing outwards from the stage. And the story goes that, despite it being a closed rehearsal with no access to the theatre, somewhere in the middle gallery there were two figures dressed in Tudor clothes. The word had obviously gotten round that the Globe was open for business again. One of our security team regularly patrols the Globe at night, and as he walks from the attic above the stage round to the North Tower, he can always feel something walking behind him. The hairs on the back of his neck go up. It's always around midnight, and only ever in that part of the theatre. What about the Sam Wanamaker Playhouse? As Rob says, it's actually a very new theatre, and he reckons it hasn't got any ghosts in it seems yet. Well, David chatted to Rona from our digital team, who has her own Playhouse ghost story.
So, I do a lot of filming here at the Globe, and one of my earliest shoots was in the Sam Wanamaker Playhouse. So I just went down to set up the big camera on this massive tripod, set it up right against the door of the stage so we could get a lovely shot of someone coming out. Of course, I'm forgetful, so I just forget my headphones upstairs, and I dash upstairs to go and get them, maybe about a 2-minute trip. I come back downstairs, come through the stage doors, and I go, where's my camera gone? And I look all around and I see it's actually been moved to the entrance to the pit, which is a good couple of feet away. And I'm kind of like, oh, someone's moved my camera, that's so annoying. But as I get closer, I can see it's almost been knocked over. It's almost been kind of pushed. And it's lying on its side. It's completely switched off. I'd left it on. And I was going, this is somewhat strange. So I go outside and I have a chat with our lovely welcome desk team and I say, who moved my camera? And they went, no one's been in the theatre. I went, no. I know that someone's moved my camera. And they go, no one set foot in that theatre since you left 2 minutes ago. Go around to security, check in with them at stage door and say, have any of you guys gone in round one of the back entrances? Absolutely no one was in the theatre between me leaving and coming back in. And somehow my camera moved from right on stage all the way down to the pit. And I've no idea how, although I think I feel like I know how. Someone was not happy that I was there. I don't love going in by myself anymore. And every time I go in since then, I do get a little chill. And I've definitely heard footsteps up in the upper gallery when you're filming and you do a quick shout and you go, hi, just to let you know, this is a live set or something. No one replies. No one's up there.
We suspected that Southwark might have had a few stories to tell, so David joined John from our exhibition team to share some of the stories that came to be told about the local area, once on the wild outskirts of London. Here's John with some of the very best and most outrageous local ghost stories and urban legends he could find.
What happens in the story of Mr. The Ghost of Mr. Phillips? He's a special English ghost type called a revenant, and basically revenants are completely physical. They don't do the like the O. Henry sort of Shirley Jackson scare you to death type ghost. And revenant will just beat you to death. Mr. Phillips was a terrible miser. He buried all his money before he died so that his wife wouldn't get it. And even after he died, he came back. His body rose again to guard his wealth. The problem is he was not a very social spook. Because he would get lost in his neighbour's gardens and trash them and wander about the area smelling bad and making noises and generally being a real sort of pain. And so eventually Mrs. Phillips, who his ghost always said was in the garden trying to find his money and dig it up, which is why he was there, but she just said, you know, don't be ridiculous, I don't want your horrible money. And anyway, she tried to get a priest to exorcise him. But of course, by then, this is like the late 16th century, the Anglican Church had banned priests from exorcising. And so she couldn't find one. So she did the next best thing. She found an actor who'd played either a priest or a wizard on stage and got him to do it. So you have this motley crew of actors, right, who come down from one of the local theatres, who come at night to the garden where Mr. Phillips is wandering around. And they do the exorcism. Pretty much from a play that they've been in. And, you know, they do the scene, they feel their motivation, and Mr. Phillips turns to them, and he says this poem, something along the lines of, you know, though you disturb my wealth, ye who try, I have known that even men may die. And then Mr. Phillips explodes. He just detonates. There is another ghost, and it's earlier than Shakespeare's era, which is the story of John Overs, who is a sort of semi-mythical figure. There was possibly a guy called John Overs who was involved in the founding of the priory, which would eventually become St. Saviour's Church, which is now Southwark Cathedral. And the story is that he was a waterman and that he was this awful, awful miser again. And that he decided, well, he didn't decide, he realised that, of course, if he died, everybody would go into mourning. And they would like be drinking water and not eating for a whole day. And he decided that was an amazing way to save a day's money. And so he got a coffin, pretended to be dead. Obviously, you know, he lays himself out in the coffin and his family all come down. But to his absolute horror, instead of going into mourning, they're excited. They're like, oh my God, he's finally dead. And they start opening his wine and, like, getting his food out of the kitchen, sitting around the coffin talking about how horrible he is. And so after a little while of this, he sits up in the coffin, you know, going, rah! But, you know, revenants are a thing. These physical ghosts are totally a thing. They assume he is now risen. And so the poor guy gets battered to death with an oar. Another good one. One of the big influential lawyers at Middle Temple Hall was a chap named Robin Bridges. Now, Bridges was a very sort of religious man. He was a borderline what we would now call Puritan, what they at the time would have called the godly. And he'd just been to a lecture about predestination, and he started to believe he was terribly evil and that he was going to go to hell. And he tried to kill himself and it didn't work. He survived. And then he started seeing things. And he went to Southwark. We wonder whether it was to, you know, have a little bit of the sin of this area being a very big red light district. And he starts seeing this black dog follow him. And so he gets kind of pursued through the area by this black dog. Until eventually he hides in a local house until it goes away. Because he even tries, if my memory serves me correctly, right, getting in the water, and it's just like happy to paddle out. And so he then goes and he just hides. And then when he gets back to the north of the river, he becomes fully demonically possessed. And for, I think it's 4 or 5 days at sort of his rooms, he then lies paralyzed and narrates his battles with the devil. And it becomes a bit of a tourist attraction. And you've got people every morning, because he's very regular, he goes on the clock at about 8 o'clock. And he usually comes off, I think it's late afternoon, it's about 4 o'clock when he usually finishes his possession. And because he's so regular, you know, people just turn up. You know, they turn up to watch Bridges' battle with the devil and watch him narrate these things happening and how the Queen of Hell is tempting him and all of this stuff. And then 4 days, it's over. That is one of the great historical walls to be a fly on. And so, yeah, those are the ones I know the best about this area.
Every half term, we put together Half Term Tales, a series of events for kids and families here at the Globe. This year, prosthetics artist Susie Battersby joined us for a special workshop in which kids made their very own severed fingers. I chatted to her after the event about the secrets behind the severed head she makes for theatre shows.
My name is Susie Battersby and I am a freelance prosthetics artist. Well, it's mostly, well, props, but not theatre props that you might normally think of. I specialise in doing prosthetic props, I guess, is the good way of describing it. So I'll do realistic silicone props for like body parts and severed heads, the kind of things that you might encounter in a Shakespeare play. Unfortunately, I mean, prosthetics that you glue on people's faces, which is something that I do quite a lot of for film and TV, it's difficult often for that to happen in theatre purely for budgetary reasons, but also because of time. You can imagine people getting ready backstage. Doing prosthetics would be quite an ordeal. So, yeah, no, mostly I do, like, realistic body parts and gory stuff like that. So they're never just any old head, right? Otherwise, you would just use something that you had in stock, right? It wouldn't matter. But I get asked in when it needs to be matching an actor. So in the case of, I mean, the first severed head I made for the Globe was for Cymbeline, which they did in 2015. And they really wanted to do something properly realistic, something to be really shocking for the audience. So I had to basically make one that looked like Callum, who is the actor doing the part. And you go from there, basically. I have to meet with them, and I have to take their skin colour, I have to take their eye colour, their hair colour. And then I also need to then take an actual cast of their head, which involves covering their faces in a life casting product. In that case, it was alginate. Basically, I smother somebody's head in that, being very careful to leave their nose free so they can breathe. It's very important. I think in every severed head I've done, I've had to re-sculpt the face a little bit to give them the expression that the director's really after. But it's difficult because you want to tread a really fine line between what looks real and what looks funny, because in real life we don't see severed heads on the street, so a lot of what is medically accurate is actually quite comical, so I often have to temper it with what they've asked for and kind of, you know, artistic license kind of suggests something that's going to do the job without it being too shocking for the audience. One of them I did recently, I had to re-sculpt it so she looked really shocked and like scared as she was getting beheaded. So she had a really quite sweet sort of frown and a screaming mouth. To be honest, I really quite love it. I don't know why. I get much more satisfaction artistically trying to create something that's real rather than something that's imaginary. There's something so satisfying about being given a brief that's true to life because it gives you something like a science that you can actually look into and research. I never get sick of it. And so for me, like a severed head, for example, it would be like, well, how did they die? Was it, you know, was it a cut with a sword? Was it a cut with an axe? Was it a blow to the head? Was it an accident? All kinds of things might lead to that happening. There's not one kind of severed head. So, and my dad's also a brain surgeon, so he's like a helpful person to have to hand and call up and say, how much bleeding would happen if this happened to this person? And he's quite used to it now. I reckon I'm 90% unflappable. There's still stuff that I look at when I'm looking up research that turns my stomach, but it's not the stuff that's the most gory, to be honest. It's the stuff that just looks unnatural, so that I find the most gruesome. So something like a broken bone that hasn't burst the skin, and you just see like an arm or a leg at an angle that looks wrong. That's the stuff that really gets me. Because I think blood and stuff, like, I'm so used to seeing it now, and I'm so used to looking at it as an artist, right? And actually, this isn't true for me. This is true for anybody you meet who does prosthetics. We're all the same. If somebody has fallen down and got a big bruise, we're all like, show us the picture. You want to see it for reference, because there's so many beautiful colours that come out of it, you know, which is a weird thing to say. But we do find beauty in skin diseases, and did this thing recently that was osteomyelitis, which is a bone infection that causes the skin above it to kind of rot. I mean, it sounds awful, it looks really, really painful, but you get this incredible array of colours in there. So I never find that stuff gory, I find it fascinating. What's weird to other people is probably not weird to me, because I make severed heads all the time. it might have to just be severed heads and decapitated bodies, but tell a lie, I have got the weirdest thing. I used to work at English National Opera in their prop workshop, and we made a enormous bottom of the Statue of David for a Terry Gilliam opera. So that's probably the weirdest, thinking about it.
How long does it take you to make
a giant bum? It was a team effort. So, you know, I don't know, I think it was, a couple of weeks? It was enormous.
You're still with us then, are you? Failed to raise so much as a goosebump, did we? If you're looking to test your nerve further, Deep Night, Dark Night, our collection of ghoulish and ghastly ghost stories, runs in the Sam Wanamaker Playhouse until the 2nd of November, and then returns with new stories on the 3rd, 4th and 5th of December. To find out more about Shakespeare's Globe, follow us on Twitter, Facebook and Instagram. You've been listening to Such Stuff, and don't worry, there's almost certainly no such thing as ghosts. Almost certainly.